This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on May 14, 2009. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
We'll reconvene the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission of Thursday, May 14, 2009. The next matter is report of the Audit Division on Friends of Wiener, agenda document 0926. Ready to proceed?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Sorry about that.
Sure.
Thank you. Before you is the report of the Audit Division on Friends of Wiener, which covers the 2004 election cycle. The report presents the following seven matters: receipt of contributions that exceed limits, failure to disclose debts and obligations, disclosure of contributions from political committees, disclosure of occupation name of employer, misstatement of financial activity, untimely deposit of contributions, disclosure of allocable activity. I'm prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Commissioner McGann? Would you like to raise your hand?
Thank you for calling on me. Being in school. Thank you. A couple questions about the proposed final report, and I'll try to move quickly. And maybe it's better for me just to kind of state the concerns, and then we can either ask questions or just debate amongst ourselves. Finding two, the debts and obligations, part of that debt is $22,500 for what I think is a service contract by a political consultant where they had some sort of invoices, but the campaign didn't necessarily pay the consultant at any sort of regular interval. I'm not sure that's really debt. And I say that because this is different than fronting postage or maybe media time or buying a newspaper ad, but I think we actually have had some cases where even that has some flexibility as to whether or not it's something that creates an issue. But it seems to me that campaigns hire people for services all the time, and if the consultant doesn't get paid till where folks who are used to sort of the paycheck every couple weeks kind of think it's suspect, doesn't make it so. People do win bonuses. They do all sorts of things. So I'm not entirely sure that that's really the sort of thing that we could second guess. Finding three, it's whether or not they adequately disclose certain contributions, and I understand that the most of those errors are concern the address. And as I read the response of the committee, they did include an address, but it wasn't the address that the FEC thought they should include. It was another address for the same entity, and it gets into whether it was a local address or the address on the statement of organization of a PAC, that sort of thing. So, kind of want some clarification on that. Finding four, I appreciate the fact that we note at the threshold that it's based on a sample. It's not a metaphysically certain number. But I still will have a question about the best efforts. Find it hard to believe that, as the audit report suggests, that the committee did not provide any evidence that at least one additional effort to obtain, maintain, and submit the missing information, either a written request or document or request, had been made. That's possible. It just seems to me a campaign that has been through a couple election cycles probably may have produced a sample letter or something, but maybe they didn't. If they didn't, then they didn't, but I want to get a sense of what happened there. Finding six with the untimely deposit of contributions, I think the auditors, many of the concerns of the request of the committee, I think, were addressed because the average versus the mean and all that kind of thing. Respondent says the average was 24 days and not, 265 days in one case, and they asked that that not be sort of the number that's brandished about. And I think the audit report is very fair in that respect, that it does make clear that that the average is about 24. It seems like they got caught up with the bank. The bank, they had credit card contributions that didn't hit the actual account. The bank was holding them up, and I'm not sure what our position is as to whether that is the fault of the campaign or is that something beyond the ability of the campaign to control, because if anyone has dealt with a bank, they know it's not an easy institution to move. And then there's finding 7, which I just don't see any basis for in the law, and it seems to me that it's not based on the regs. It's based upon a new theory that doesn't apply to federal campaigns and state campaigns, and I think that it is something that I've seen quite a bit in cases since I've been here, where someone acts a certain way that seems to be consistent with established law, but then after the fact something changes. We've seen that with respect to mailing lists for independent expenditures. There's an advisory opinion on point, but yet there was some sense that that really somehow didn't apply. We've seen it with party committee swaps. We had one case where the party committee swapped money with other state parties, and then there was a sort of an after-the-fact circumvention theory that didn't seem to reflect the actual law. There had been whether or not a party has to put disclaimers on their polls. That's another case where it seemed like nobody thought you did, but then all of a sudden there was a theory that you did, and that was after the folks did the poll. And then we have this case where a member of Congress decided to run for mayor, had a mayoral campaign, and now we're going to impose a ratio on that spending based upon the funds raised, which is the ratio for fundraising events done by federal and non-federal accounts of PACs. That's not the reg. The reg does not apply to campaigns. I don't want to prolong it because I know there was a discussion this morning on a matter from which I was recused as to whether or not the campaigns provided documents and that kind of thing. I think part of my reaction to that argument is that until you know the applicable legal standard, it's really tough to accuse someone of not producing documents, because it's easy to keep the legal standard moving to a point where all of a sudden the documents don't address the facts that would be relevant under a certain legal theory. Those of you who've done courtroom work, discovery disputes, a lot of times someone will request documents, and then your response will be, I don't have any, and then there'll be a dispute saying, well, you failed to produce these documents, and the answer is, well, under the legal theory that the plaintiffs raised, they're not relevant or reasonably calculated to lead to discovery of admissible evidence, but they are if the rule changed. And sometimes I feel like we have, a car wreck that occurred halfway down the block where somebody pulled out of a driveway, and we're all hung up on whether the light was red or yellow or green when it was nowhere near the intersection. So merely because a campaign may not know what color the light was, I'm not so sure that's at all relevant to something that happened far away from the traffic light. And that's kind of an awkward analogy, but that's kind of how I see finding 7. So that's kind of where I am, and I did this in one long breath, and I don't mean to overwhelm Mr. Bonowitz, but I thought it would help everyone just to see where I'm coming from, and maybe we can move this through a little bit quickly. So the first thing is, can we talk for a minute about the debt? And this consultant who, I think, am I correct, it's a services contract?
That's correct.
He didn't front any money, or this is not something where, a political consultant picked up some obligation of the committee, and then they didn't pay their bill for a long time, so you have some in-kind.
Well, in this case, what we saw were invoices for monthly fees that accrued from February to June, so which hadn't been paid.
Right.
We didn't look at them in terms of them being a contribution, but we did, as we would other vendors, look at it as a debt reporting issue.
What if the person just said, you know what, even though I sent you an invoice, you don't owe me any money, I just was helping you out, I'm a volunteer. He could do that, right?
Yes, to some extent. Isn't it legal, I think limited to legal and accounting, or no? Okay.
Okay. It seems to me it's not the sort of reportable debt that raises the sort of concern that fronting money for a campaign would raise if a consultant fronts all kinds of cash, like I mentioned earlier, for postage or that, or TV advertising, or real out of pockets, and they don't report that. That's something that really does kind of compromise what the public knows. But individual services, to me, are not, I don't think, or should be treated the same. But, you know, maybe they are, maybe they're not. But it seems to me that's not the sort of thing that should stay in the report. But it's not just up to me. The adequate disclosure of contributions, am I right that a lot of these concern the address of,
correct,
of the source of the funds?
The political committees?
Right.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Now, the committee says that, well, we had an address, it just wasn't the address that maybe was the most pristine address, or wasn't the address the FEC necessarily had on its list of addresses.
In these cases, we tried to associate the address with maybe another location of the PAC. We could not see where these addresses were associated with the entity.
Okay. But the committee does say they were addresses that were in large part correct. They just weren't the addresses that you had on your address sheet based upon maybe reports that the PAC filed, or?
That's correct. That's the committee's position.
Okay. So whether or not it's adequate, it seems like there's an address. It's just whether it's the right address.
Correct. We couldn't verify in our minds that it was an address that was an adequate substitute for what we had.
Okay. So we don't really know if it's adequate or inadequate. At least I don't know that. But is that a reasonable sort of take from
what we know is we couldn't find any way to associate it with the entity. So in that respect, we don't think it's adequate. And just to give you a sort of an example in another area, take disbursements addresses, for instance. If there's an address, if there's a disbursement and the address for FedEx is one location, but we can see the address they reported is another FedEx location, that would probably be acceptable. But we didn't have that sort of information in this case. We couldn't associate the address with the contributor.
But what about the response of the committee, where they actually, in their letter, page 6 and 7, for example, Planned Parenthood Action Fund, $2,000, and they say the address reported is that of the Connected Organization's national office in New York. The political committee's address on FEC Form 1 is the organization's office in Washington, D.C. Are we really going to say that's inadequate because they reported the parent? I mean, doesn't the public still kind of know where the money's coming from? We really can't say that we don't have any information. I mean, they've provided it. We just can't verify it.
We took the position that address was not the PAC's address.
Okay.
And I don't know in the past that we've accepted what they're saying, where if it's the location of the national organization in another city.
Okay. What about the next one, the High Need Hospital PAC? $1,000, and they claim the address reported was the registered address at the beginning of the cycle, but then the High Need Hospital PAC changed the address during the cycle. So they used the address that they found for the beginning of the cycle, but then I guess they said they had a little trouble figuring out the address changed. We're not really going to say that's inadequate, are we?
We did, because the old address would not have gotten, was not where the committee was located.
Okay.
So,
but if they're saying they used the address that was the registered address at the beginning of the cycle, they're not going to know if it's the right or wrong address. They're just using the publicly available information on that recipient's address, right? And to be fair, there is stuff they made mistakes on. I think there is stuff where they admit that, you know, look, they had the wrong address or they had the wrong political. So I'm not saying that the whole finding is, but there are some things on the margins here that seem to be kind of nitpicky.
I don't have the detailed work papers in front of me. I could go back and take a look, but going by memory, I don't think that we saw that was an address formerly used. I'd have to go back and double check, though.
Okay. The occupation and employer finding And it's just a sample. The sample kicked out about 30%. The respondent claims, I shouldn't say respondent, the committee, say it was really less than 10%. And it seems your response is, well, they didn't provide any evidence to support this assertion. So we sort of are creeping back into the, well, the committee hasn't really proven that they're innocent. But they also, in their response, say they asked for some of the what was in the sample to try to debunk the sample and see if the sample was correct, and that wasn't provided. Is that true?
No, we provided the committee the information that it needed.
What you used for your sample? Okay,
yes.
So they're wrong when they say they didn't get it?
Yes.
Okay. With the deposits, the untimely deposits, which is the next suggested finding, mm-hmm. Is that something that was within the credit card issue? Is that something that was really within the control of the committee, or is that something that they sort of contracted it out and they thought the bank would take the money from the credit cards and put it in their account, but the bank wasn't doing it? They were doing like a sweep that was months late. I mean, can the campaign really control that, or?
The campaign probably should have been monitoring that.
Okay.
If they,
I mean, what is true?
With them to provide,
I mean, it didn't hit the bank within 10 days, right?
Correct.
So there's no,
yes.
There's no question that it didn't hit the bank within 10 days.
Right.
The question really is why and who's to blame. Okay. And then that brings us to finding 7. Where to begin? Someone's a federal office holder. They run for state office. BCRA makes clear you can do that and raise money subject to the state laws, notwithstanding the BCRA soft money ban. I think the law is equally clear. If a federal campaign wants to give money to the state campaign, they can. Under federal laws, state law may run. They may run into a problem, and apparently they did. But that, to me, doesn't affect whether or not it's legal under federal law. And I don't see where we can second guess what they did unless there's something I don't know. It seems to me that what the commission has historically done is look to the stated purpose. In fact, there's an advisory opinion, 99-11 from 1999, where that's the language used by the commission. The commission looks to the stated purpose of the state campaign activity. There's no really ratio or that kind of thing. When there is a ratio, it's for split costs, and the reg talks about what you need to split. But a general sort of imposition of a standard that's not in the regs after the fact, I'm not following. And with respect to Mr. Bono, it's not really a question for you. I mean, it's a legal question, and it's really more for the commission as to what we do in these situations. But I don't see what they did wrong with respect to they being the committee, what they did wrong with respect to finding 7. And that's my concerns on this audit, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Further questions, comment? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had some of the same concerns about the finding 7 as well. Normally, when we have a candidate who's simultaneously running for both federal and state office, our greatest concern is that non-federal dollars, those that aren't subject to the prohibitions, limitations, and reporting requirements of the Act, we don't want those to be subsidizing federal campaign activities. And it seems like here we have kind of the opposite issue, where it looks like, to a very large extent, Mr. Weiner was using his federal committee funds in order to subsidize some of his his mayor, his campaign for mayor, and under the Act, prior to you know, prior to 2002, there are a number of advisory opinions where it was considered a lawful purpose under Section 439A to transfer federal campaign funds in order to make a run for either state or local office. And then in as a part of the omnibus 2005, I think, FY 2005, omnibus, there was an amendment to BCRA to also add in a provision saying that money spent with respect to state and local candidates, which Mr. Weiner was in this case as well, is considered a permitted use. And so I have some of the same, have the same question about whether, you know, is there a violation here, a personal use violation, or is the question that there may have been a reporting issue? I guess that's the question I have: is what is the what's the problem that we see with respect to finding seven?
Thank you.
The issue here is mainly a disclosure issue. We're not saying that one campaign subsidized the other. You're correct in saying that the Weiner campaign paid for a lot more than the mayoral campaign. So this is merely an issue of disclosure of these allocable costs.
Commissioner McGann?
I thought you were imposing or suggesting imposing a ratio on the spending that was different from what they actually spent. I thought we're saying that they spent money from their federal account and from their state campaign, that it wasn't the correct ratio.
They never provided us with documentation showing how they allocated the costs. Their position was they allocated on usage, and absent documentation and other information, the best we could do was use the funds received method to come up with some sort of way to allocate these administrative costs. They're all simply administrative costs for offices the two campaigns were sharing.
What evidence do you have that how they spent the money in the first instance was wrong, that would then maybe prompt the question about prove it up, otherwise we're going to impose some ratio on you?
I don't know that I'd say they were wrong. They were never able to document to us how they came up with the ratios for different categories of expenses. They were allocated in different manners. So they never provided us documentation or information on how they came up with this allocation they used.
But if the stated purpose is for what they say it is, why do we go behind that and seek additional documentation, as I hear it, from a committee that's beyond the reach of federal election law, a state, actually a local mayoral campaign? I'm at a loss of what kind of documents we're looking for. Are we talking about sort of micromanaging how they lease the photocopier and, you know, why they split up the cost there? Are we talking more than the photocopier and the phone bill?
Well, we're also talking about rent and salary, so it's more than just the copier and phone bill. The rent, I believe, was entirely paid by the mayoral campaign. And looking at, when we did the audit of Weiner, looking at their reports, it was noticeable that there weren't some administrative costs that there probably should be. And we had indications that they were sharing this space. So we looked at administrative expenses on both sides for 2004 and identified those costs that we felt were admin overhead related and considered those to be shared, and then Of course, we tried to come up with a ratio, and there was they gave us no documentation on how they came up with their calculations, so we were left with funds received method as the only way we could come up with some sort of way to allocate these costs.
How though does the funds received ratio, assuming we can just apply a ratio that wasn't on the books and still isn't on the books at the time this committee, these committees were actually making real decisions in real time, how does that ratio, a funds received ratio based upon fundraising numbers, mm-hmm. how does that relate to the actual benefit received by the campaigns when it comes to the spending side? I mean, there's always been a distinction, at least since Buckley, between money coming in and money going out. Are we now saying there isn't a distinction? I'm at a loss here on why you're using this ratio.
We're using it because we have no other alternative. We have no other information to come up with any sort of other ratio, where if we had information on space utilized by each campaign, or maybe timesheets for the employees, you can make allocation sometimes based on salary. So absent any other alternative, that was the only vehicle left for us to come up with a way to allocate these costs. We're not saying it's the best. We're saying it's all we had.
See, I don't know if I agree with there's no other way. We're stuck. They spent money. We know they spent money. They made a decision at the time to mm-hmm. split certain costs. They made a decision not to split other costs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now we're questioning those decisions as well. Right, and we're looking at whether their decision to have the state campaign, mayoral campaign pay someone directly, or the federal campaign pay someone directly. We're second guessing that decision and saying, well, maybe they didn't get that right. Maybe there should be some sort of ratio because maybe that was actually a cause that was beneficial to both entities.
We met with the committee officials frequently over this.
Right, and they probably said they don't have another way because what they did was correct. That's not the same as saying they didn't provide an explanation or they didn't propose their own ratio. They're not going to negotiate with themselves.
Even with them saying it's correct, just for one example, as an auditor, I would take exception to the rent, with the mayoral paying the entire rent for the period and the campaign not. There's evidence they were both utilizing the same space, so there should have been some payments for rent by Friends of Wiener.
In that case, though, there is an argument that it's de minimis, isn't it? He had his office at home,
Dave,
and he was collecting mail at the other place.
That the committee has raised that in their response, right. That it's de minimis.
But why would you discount that?
They didn't give us any anything to support how they came up with the assertion that it was de minimis in nature.
A case like that, though, if a person says, I've got my office at home, that's where I am, that's where I do my business, what more can you say?
In this case, we had trouble. They did raise that as the location of Friends of Wiener's office. However, we had evidence that mail was going from that, being forwarded to the mayoral office, as well as other indicators that showed activity with respect to Friends of Wiener was taking place at this office where the mayoral campaign was.
You know, it's likely. I mean, he's entitled to go to both places, but I'm just wondering why, from a perspective here, that seems like an easy one. If somebody says, hey, I've got my office at home, this is where I spend my time, this is what I'm doing, and we can say, sorry, we're going to attribute it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that makes sense in other areas, but that particular one would seem to me hard to disbelieve somebody. That was my only thought. I didn't mean to interrupt, Commissioner Beverly. We don't want to interrupt Commissioner McGann.
I appreciate the chairman's point. It's headed the same direction I'm headed. This kind of notion that, well, that, you know, we didn't know what to do because they didn't provide anything. Well, they told us that the congressman was using his home basically for his congressional reelect. So of course he's going to be paying the rent with the mayoral money. And this is one of the frustrating points of BCRA in so many ways, is that the clash between the federal law and the state law. Some states, like Connecticut, you can't use federal money in their state elections. And if you guess wrong on some sort of ratio, you violated state law. And I think New York might have this. There's a similar double-edged sword here in New York, as evidenced by the fact that the mayoral campaign apparently settled a matter with the state officials. But the heads I win, tails you lose sort of approach gets very frustrating to people trying to actually run campaigns. And it makes perfect sense to me that he was going to use only mayoral money to pay for the office, because he's in a relatively safe federal congressional seat, and he was ultimately reelected to that seat by a big margin. And the concern that should arise, and the question I think really to ask, is did the federal campaign receive a benefit from the state campaign, which is essentially what the vice chair was raising. And I just don't see the benefit. I mean, if the state campaign is really subsidizing the federal campaign with respect to rent, then I think that is a problem. Factually, I don't see that. I see potentially de minimis use at best. And I don't think de minimis use allows for the launching of a whole nother ratio that does not apply to campaigns based upon the money raised, which has nothing to do with the spending of the campaign. I don't understand it. The salaries, I think, is actually a worse approach, because the committee says they paid people directly. For example, they say fees and wages were paid to the primary fundraiser, and they were paid from the separate committees. And the committee says it's unclear why the audit staff listed her fees paid by one committee as allocable to the other campaign. I agree with that statement. It's unclear to me, and any sort of clarity you could provide would help. I mean, you can work for more than one campaign at a time, and I think each campaign can pay you directly. This is not a situation like a PAC, where the PAC has to use the overhead ratio for people to do the federal and non-federal kind of stuff, right? I mean, there have been PACs that have tried to pay people directly out of the federal account and then directly out of the non-federal account. This agency has said, no, you can't do that. You have to use the overhead ratio. But that's not the case with campaigns, right? Because it's not a PAC. This is not a leadership PAC with a federal and non-federal. You have two separate campaigns. If they've paid people directly, what's the evidence to say that was incorrect, which would then allow for some sort of second-guessing and imposing some sort of split?
We asked repeatedly for them to give us the rationale for their allocations, any sort of information on why they felt salary should be allocated for Azaria, for instance, at 27% versus 73%, but we never got anything more than a narrative response that says that's the way we did it.
See, but this comes back to the, well, we're gonna blame the committee for not providing information when they made a decision, and they made it at the time, and it doesn't seem unreasonable. It seems to me the law has to allow some sort of breathing room for people who make decisions in the ever increasingly complicated world of campaign finance regulation. And I come back to this AO, and just so everyone knows what I'm talking about, the AO was requested by Diane Byram back in the 2000 cycle. She was in the Michigan State Senate. She was going to run for federal office, and she had done activities as a state office holder using state campaign funds. And there were coffees, and she had these coffees, and she asked the AO, saying, can I keep having these coffees without having the federal campaign have to pay? And when you read the language of the AO, it couldn't be clearer. It says, in determining whether expenses for events in which federal candidates participate are being incurred for the purpose of influencing a federal election, which I really think is the standard we have to use here for whether we allocate, right? That's what the statute says. And it says the commission has examined the stated purpose of these activities. I read that AO as saying we look to the stated purpose, not the perhaps behind-the-scenes purpose, or that we look what they actually did and what the content is of what they did, not what we imagine it might have been. And it says the commission has concluded that events in which federal officeholders participate in their capacities as officeholders are not for the purpose of influencing a federal election, simply because the officeholders may be candidates for election to federal office. To me, that debunks what I'm hearing, which is because you're running for two offices, there must be something we need. There must be something sketchy about how you're paying for things, and we have to micromanage how you're splitting up costs or not splitting up costs, but instead paying directly for services rendered to a separate entity. And then later, this is particularly enlightening language. You stated that neither she, meaning the candidate, nor any of her representatives will solicit any contribution or expressly advocate her election during the course of this activity. Discussion at the events will be limited to issues relating to her constituents' needs or issues affecting her state senatorial district. No advertising of the events will take place outside her Senate district. Here's an AO talking about, unless you're asking for money for your federal campaign or expressly advocating for your federal campaign, it's not the sort of thing the commission's going to get into. And what I don't understand is why now in an audit we're going to get into this when I thought the law was pretty clear that you could run for a non-federal office while also running for federal office or serving as a federal office holder. I'm just really hung up on what we're doing here. And the idea that, well, they didn't provide documents just doesn't cut it. I don't think they have to for their stake for their mayoral campaign. They're allowed to spend that money however state law allows it or not allows it. And they're allowed to spend their federal office, federal campaign money, everything short of personal use. It's not a personal use to spend money on another state campaign or local campaign. Vice Chair made that point. And I'm just hung up on how we get this ratio. And then even if we do want to do an allocation ratio, how do we use the fundraising ratio to get at the benefit derived? How do we get at what's an in-kind and what's not an in-kind using a fundraising ratio? It's apples and oranges.
That particular AO was of interest to me too. I left it on my, I had it in the cool part of my binder. But is that one that could be elaborated on in terms of how that's perceived here?
You know, the question that comes up with a case like this, you're seeing these running for re-election. Agreed, it's a fairly safe district, but he did spend almost $1.5 million doing it. Had very little in the line of overhead expenses. You would expect to see some overhead expenses if they're raising and spending that kind of money.
Mr. Stoltz, are you talking about the mayoral campaign didn't have a lot of overhead?
No, the congressional.
Congressional, okay, right.
Congressional.
Okay.
And so we inquire about, because some things, you know, are more of a concern due to their absence than they are their presence. And, you know, there is a representation that they use the candidate's apartment a lot, but there's also a representation, well, we had the mail sent over here and we did all these other things over here because there's nobody home a lot, which then suggests, well, are you sure you're using that as campaign headquarters if there's nobody home and you have to send your mail someplace else? And the, you know, we see him paying for a photocopying machine. Well, that's over here, and some of the other contracts that relate to that office are in this committee's name. So the question that the auditors ask themselves is, okay, we understand there's two campaigns here. We understand that they're one's federal, one's non-federal. They're allowed to do that. But the expenses need to be accounted for separately. When you reach that point, then if you either have to say, well, as long as they say this is the decision they made, then that's the end of the inquiry. Or do we need to say, all right, can you show us? Do you have documentation that shows why you pay this much here and this much here? And in this case, and as you know, with others, a lot of times I don't think that when this activity is going on, people are necessarily thinking about creating a document trail or creating records. And so we get there and there's precious little to look at. I think, you know, we have acknowledged all along that the fundraising ratio may not be ideal here. They did both raise money and there was obviously expenses involved with that. and you know maybe a fundraising ratio would be good for that. But absent anything else, we looked at what we could, you know, what information do we have at hand that we can use to at least estimate benefit. Now, you know, maybe we disagree that that was the way to do it, even if we didn't have anything else. But that was the approach that we took in an attempt to see if things were done reasonably well. In this case, we concluded that money-wise, it came out pretty close, but that there needed to be some disclosure acknowledgement of the fact that the two were going on and they were both paying expenses. And that's what we had asked them to do. And so far, you know, that's not happened. And they make the argument that the whole ratio thing is, you know, doesn't apply and shouldn't apply. I don't know where that leaves us when we go out and try to verify representations. I understand this is what they said they did, and they did it at the time. Doesn't really help down the road when we're trying to decide whether or not they did it materially correctly. Anyhow, we don't, we don't expect perfection and all this stuff because that doesn't exist, but at least materially correctly.
I have a question in connection with the home issue. What could somebody give your office that would satisfy you that this person was spending more time there and there, or maybe productively or not? Or I'm just wondering. It seems to me that's an easy one where you can check somebody representation, unless you really are tracking some person down, and you can't expect somebody to make fill out timesheets as to where they were necessarily. So I just wonder, what would you be looking for, or what did you ask them for to help you with that allocation issue?
Alex can probably answer that better than I.
Yeah, we asked them for anything they could provide. I mean, timesheets would have been great if they had timesheets, monthly timesheets that showed, you know, I spent this time on the mayoral and this amount of time on Wiener, but
we didn't get anything. How many candidates keep timesheets when they have two campaigns or something like that? You know, that would be realistically. Yeah, but I can answer real quick.
This is probably, I think, the first audit I did that had two campaigns running concurrently. So, I can't think of another audit instance where I had.
Mr. Bowerly.
I just have a follow-up factual question. When we're talking about overhead, we're talking about the campaign staff, correct? We're not talking about where the candidate spent his time. I don't think that's necessary. I mean, aren't we talking about where the staff who would have opened the mail that you said was redirected to the mayoral office, and who is spending time, where the time was being spent on the campaigns?
Correct. These are individuals we believe were working at the office. One was, two of them, I believe, were finance people. One was a data person. So we believe these are the type of people that would have been working at an office.
But we don't have any information with respect to, they didn't provide us with any documentation of where the fundraiser, for example, which is the sort of a pretty big chunk of the amount in dispute with respect to the $52,000. We don't have a location for that particular person.
No, we don't.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner McGann.
Following up on that, with certain staff were paid by the federal campaign and they were paid by the mayoral campaign.
Correct.
And what's wrong with that? They should keep timesheets?
No. Well,
because what the response is, they estimated the time that would be spent on each campaign. They paid accordingly.
Mm-hmm. For
what do they do then?
For a portion of these individuals, it was just noted as salary. Like I said, some of them were finance people. These were the type of duties that we felt the person could have been doing with respect to both campaigns, especially since they were being paid by each in some cases. So the question comes up, for instance, for the finance person, how much did they spend on finance with respect to the mayoral and how much with respect to the congressional campaign. And absent timesheets, we have no way to come up with that. And we've asked the committee over and over again how they came up with paying the people the way they did, and they've gotten no information. And we're just trying to assure ourselves that this was done reasonably. We're not saying there was anything impermissible here. We're merely saying this is a disclosure issue. And under the regs, it says they each should be paying their respective portions. In this case, we have overlap, and we just are asking for disclosure of those activities.
But it's not just disclosure, because I'm reading the proposed final audit report, and I see on page 21, kind of in the middle of the page there, where the paragraph begins, therefore, $155K inallocable expenditures made by Friends of Wiener would be allocated $9,000 and change to the federal campaign and $146 and change to the mayoral committee. The campaign didn't allocate it that way.
No, they
didn't. This is you saying that's what they should have done.
Based on the information we have available, yes,
right.
And using funds received because we don't have an alternative method.
It's not just a reporting issue, it's a spending issue, right? This isn't just this isn't a situation. When I hear reporting, I'm thinking, well, the federal campaign spent money for the state campaign, and they just didn't disclose it as an in-kind, they just showed it as rent. Okay,
no.
So they got the report wrong. That's a reporting issue. But if you're saying that the way they spent the money was wrong.
We're not saying that. We're saying all we're asking for is that they disclose that this was an allocable expenditure benefiting both. And the only vehicle we could come up with in discussions with the committee is using the memo feature of fact file reporting and just indicating it was a shared expense.
So the next sentence, the $52,988 in such expenditures paid by the mayoral committee would be allocated $3,174 to Friends of Wiener and $49,814 to itself. That's not then a $3,174 in-kind from the mayoral campaign to the federal campaign?
We did not view it as such. Usually when we have these situations or similar situations, we look at the offsetting nature from both sides, and we didn't think anything impermissible arose because Friends of Wiener paid a greater portion of mayoral expenses than the mayoral paid of Friends of Wiener. So we didn't see there being a in-kind contribution arising to Friends of Wiener. And in with respect to those expenses, we simply asked them to file memo entries, similarly disclosing them as shared expenses.
Back to the timesheets, that's an intriguing concept. To have campaign workers keep timesheets.
I only suggest that because we see that with respect to other committees, and that would be another alternative way to allocate.
Because the law requires it, right? When it comes to federal election activity for party committees, there's a specific language in the rules.
Correct.
That says you have to keep timesheets, right? And if you don't, then you have a problem. And we've had that come up. People have done affidavits and kind of cured and that kind of thing. But there's nothing in the current law which would have tipped off Congressman Wiener that maybe his campaign should have been keeping timesheets, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And it's one thing if you work for a party committee, that's your employer, and you have to keep track of your time for purposes of what kind of money you can be paid, what kind of money pays your salary. Because it's still coming from the same employer, it's still the same party committee, and it ends up being an allocation issue, whether one disagrees or agrees with that approach is not really the issue for us to decide because it is what it is there. But that seems to be a whole different situation when you have two separate entities, right? You have a congressional campaign, you have a mayoral campaign. It's not the same kind of timesheet obligation. Right, you're having sort of cross-pollination. I just don't see as a practical matter folks can be keeping timesheets. Maybe the easiest way to say this is it seems that given that this doesn't happen much, but it does happen. But it does happen more often, I think, with state parties. Remember the Missouri party audit? We had the same discussion. They had issue ads or express advocacy, I don't recall, but geared towards their gubernatorial nominee. We had a long discussion about, well, they didn't really prove that up, so therefore maybe that was federal election activity. Well, or maybe it wasn't. It seems to me, though, some of the stuff is outpacing the regs, because here we have an audit where we're essentially concocting a standard after the fact. Standard that I don't think is the right, even if there is something that needs to be allocable. Let's take the rent. Let's say there was de minimis use of the congressional. The congressional campaign did have de minimis use of the mayoral space that the mayoral campaign paid for. The funds raise ratio doesn't really accurately reflect that. And I think I agree with the chair that, you know, the guy was using his house and he was really running for mayor, so it's not really surprising that he was using mayoral campaign funds to pay that rent. But I'm trying to get a sense of maybe what the rules should be and how we should go about getting at this, because this is just going to keep coming up and coming up and coming up, because when it's legal to run for two offices, people are going to do what's legal. And it doesn't, you're not prohibited from doing, I don't see where what they did is prohibited. It may not be the ideal, it may not be the perfect way to do it in the rearview mirror, but when they're driving down the road of getting elected, I don't see anything they did here that is prohibited, illegal, or otherwise unreasonable. And I'm kind of curious as to what, if anyone has any thoughts on what maybe the rule ought to be, or at least what the standard ought to be in this case, because I'm still hung up on the whole premise.
I kind of go back to the conversation we had a little earlier, but that you were there, when you have a situation when may really be able to call into question the funds received allocation approach for maybe on the basis that there's really a very scanty other evidence that justifies implementing that, but you don't have another one in terms of audit responsibility. Could it, let's just take this particular case, be appropriate to just suggest that we think allocation was required, allocation wasn't. We don't have enough documentation to apply any allocation formula based upon what we have, but we do think that we will presume that there was an allocation required, something along that line, without trying to find an approach that is untenable in some instances more than others. But in this case, it seems to me it's a little bit untenable in some of these areas. I direct that back so you kind of repeat what our conversation this morning.
Yes,
Mr. Stoltz,
we talked about
the benefit
that.
Of Mr.
And I think that's fine. If we want to reach a conclusion that, you know, based on the records we have, there appeared to be some sharing of resources between the two, and that records don't provide us sufficient information to verify or disprove what they've done, and leave it at that. It's certainly a true statement that that's where we are with it, because, you know, otherwise we are left with, well, if that's the way they did it, it must be right, and that leaves us unable really to say, yeah, it was or it wasn't. I mean, obviously, people made these decisions and how they were going to do this stuff at the time, and none of it got, apparently the decision-making process didn't get recorded. Not a huge surprise, but it didn't. We are then asked to go out and say, well, did this campaign comply with the rules? And there's no record on a lot of these sorts of things. And we're left in either trying to do some estimates of our own, which is what we did here, or saying can't tell. New York City Board, I think they appear to have been pretty much in the same situation with this committee.
Give us a again.
But I disagree we've been talking past each other, I think. I disagree that there was a complete absence of records here and that, well, we just didn't know what to do because, well, the campaign didn't provide records, right? We know the campaign, I mean, the federal campaign spent money, and I assume they kept records for that, right? Just like any campaign would keep the minimal sort of records that they're required to keep to back up their FEC reports. I don't think that's the issue. So there are records. It's that they spent money that then spilled over to the mayoral campaign, and that's not illegal. Now, if they should have reported that as an in-kind to the state, to the mayoral campaign, that's a much more narrow question, and that is a reporting issue. But it seems to me we're going well beyond that. Secondly, mayoral campaigns, state campaigns, and the like are not the sort of things that the Federal Election Commission ordinarily has jurisdiction over. And state committees or local parties that don't file with the commission or non-federal sides of state parties lack records. I don't think we can really get all bent out of shape on that, because under federal law, I'm not so sure that we can really expect them to have records. And it's not surprising to me when other committees or not federal committees don't have the same sort of record keeping that the federal law imposes. If a state campaign or local campaign lacks records, then maybe that's a violation of the state law. But I don't see how we can get all wrapped around the axle, draw some inference and the like against these folks by sort of blaming them for not providing an alternate read, when I don't see what they did as being unreasonable. I guess it really gets into the burden of proof. It seems like burden shifting to say, well, we didn't know what to do, so therefore we're going to presume they did something that wasn't right and we're going to impose a ratio, versus is there any indication that what they did was improper? And if so, then we go forward and, okay, we look at some overlap, which I think they concede that I think they concede it happened, and I think they tried to explain it and put some context on it. And when you look at the amount of expenses you're talking about, just under $1,400 worth of campaign supplies that were on the credit card of the congressional campaign that the mayoral committee paid for. Well, it supplies for the mayoral campaign. That makes sense. You know, photocopier, stuff like this. But then when I see the next paragraph, we're talking $155,000 worth of expenses. That's not photocopiers and office supplies, I don't think. I think that's in the much more real spending. And when you get into that sort of thing, I think you get into the difference between the two campaigns. And I think you have to look at what the people were actually doing, and if they were doing state campaign work, we can't presume that benefits the federal campaign and vice versa. I mean, after all, there's an advisory opinion that talks about the commission looks to the stated purpose of the activity. If we're going to change that, we do that in the rulemaking, not in an audit. For years the agency was criticized for regulation via MER. Now we're regulation via audit. And I just can't support second guessing these folks without more, because it's a standard in search of a fact pattern here, and it's the fact pattern for the standard is when you raise money, how you pay for the cost of the fundraising, wholly unrelated to how you spend money. It's a completely different approach, and I just can't at this point support finding 7, but I don't want to really belabor it, because we can have it. We can talk all day about it. And if it's okay, I'd like to actually ask one question I forgot to ask on the best efforts. Did they produce any sort of form letter or anything that they used, that they claimed they sent out, or did they just not do best efforts?
To my recollection, they didn't provide us any documentation that they sent follow-up efforts.
At all?
At all.
No response device, no letter, nothing. They just, okay. All right. Thank you.
Commissioner Arlen. No, go ahead.
I share my colleague's concern about not belaboring this. I think we've had a full discussion, and it sounds like there is not agreement with respect to finding 7, and you had some other issues with respect to other findings, so I think I'm curious as to what other findings are maybe subject to dispute so that we can figure out what how we might be able to move forward, if there are any findings that we can move forward on. I don't want to make assumptions. If I might just put that question out there, I have just a few comments on finding 7, but I want to just make sure I understand what other concerns there
if
might
be. If we could leave that question out there, that'd be great. I'd like to take about 10 minutes, and then but let's finish off with finding 7. The questions on that, if we could. So,
thank you.
Yeah, please feel free.
I think this particular case presents a more unusual situation than we usually see because there was money going both ways. There were things that were paid for by the mayoral campaign that perhaps should have been paid for by the congressional campaign and vice versa. And I think the audit reports in their sort of final analysis suggesting that these things need to be reported in this way as opposed to moving the money back and forth suggested that maybe there's a wash. I did want to note with respect to what the vice chairman said earlier with respect to personal use, as I read that, and this is perhaps a question for our lawyers, it said that it's that the donations can go to the state or local candidate subject to the provisions of state law. And I think my understanding is perhaps the reason that there was an issue with the city committee is because this candidate at that point was participating in a public financing system where the limits were starkly lower than the general limits. And so I don't know if that presents an issue or not. I think that's something I'd like to know a little bit more about, but it sounds like we may not have consensus on the underlying finding to even and get to that question. And that's not an audit question. That's a legal question. But I do think that's perhaps relevant to why this does matter. I mean, I agree with you that, you know, you certainly can run for two offices at once, but there are rules about allocating the costs that are associated with each of those. And I think that I don't want to get into an area where we read that as meaningless and you can just, you know, throw sort of everything out there and never have to account for how you're spending that money, because when the funds go one way from the state to the federal, there may be source or dollar amount restrictions that are not being that may not be required under state law but are required under federal law. And in this case, where there may be some money flowing the other direction, we have a statute that says it's permitted to move the money from federal to state so long as it complies with state law. And generally, that's not our purview. We don't have any jurisdiction over that, except we have a regulation that says we have to understand whether it's subject to the provisions of state law. So I think this case presents more issues than what we usually see is sort of the money coming from a state campaign into a federal. With respect to some of the specifics, specific expenditures, I agree that I think it's – I was surprised not to see any sort of rent and maybe some of the other overhead costs associated with the federal campaign. And I did note that for some portion of 2004 from July to October, when you would expect perhaps the most activity out of that federal race, there were some expenses that were wholly paid by the federal campaign. So I think that the committee acknowledged some of that, and I think the only question is, you know, did they cover all of it? I agree that the funds received method may not be the best approach with respect to things like overhead, but I do think that might be something that's relevant to perhaps fundraising salaries. Maybe more relevant. Maybe it's still not the perfect measure, but it might be. So I think when we don't have much to go on, perhaps the chairman's suggestion that we draw fewer conclusions rather than more might be one way we might approach this, if we can reach some consensus on that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm wondering if, no objection, can we take 10 minutes? Thank you. We'll reconvene our 10-minute break. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will start a motion that I believe others have some additions to make to it. And for those following along on tape or in person, I'm going to move that the adoption of the report of the audit division with some changes that we hope the auditors will agree to, describing, making some modifications to the description of, particularly in finding 7, with respect to whether that there appear to be some amounts that may have required allocation. However, there appears to be the audit staff could not allocate these expenses between the two campaigns based on the documents provided. This language comes from something that circulated by the chairman earlier on this matter. I believe one of my colleagues at least has a few additional changes to make to
Commissioner McGann?
The report.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to supplant the motion, I guess supplement the motion. With respect to finding 7, the chairman's proposed language is okay, except for the phrase appear to have derived some benefit. And I think we have can kind of meet halfway and change that to which may or may not have required allocation. And then the statement that FOW did not provide documentation from which the audit staff could allocate these expenses between the FOW and the candidate's mayoral campaign. That's okay. But if we could change the appear to have derived some benefit to something along the lines of may or may not have required allocation, that would I think solve the concern in addition to the other edits. And if we could make sure that what I just said there's a conforming edit made to any other of the proposed changes in finding 7. With respect to finding 2, strike. The consultant's debt, the $22,500. So the audit report as adopted would not find that was debt that should have been reported, and then make any conforming changes with that, which would be included but not limited to the opening sentence of finding 2, the $40,484 number would come down accordingly. Finding 3, I don't think we're prepared to adopt at this time, and I think part of the motion is to refer that back to the auditors. The issue that I raised regarding whether there was adequate disclosure with the addresses, maybe seen as a technical point, but when the respondent says that they used addresses that were correct, just not the addresses that the commission had or whatnot, I think we need to take a second look at that, and I think we could send that back and not necessarily adopt that finding, but once we sort that out and see if it really was adequate or inadequate, then we can adopt that finding. But perhaps we do that when we send this back, and I think the idea is to circulate this and make these edits and then come through on a tally vote, sort of with a no objection basis or something, so we weekly see these changes. So I guess part of the motion then would be to address the issues that were raised at the table regarding finding 3, regarding whether or not there really were, whether it was inadequate disclosure of 22 contributions, whether that number's less. I think we need to take a look at that and have the audit report reflect that. The remainder I'm not crazy about, but I'm fine with for now. I've already noted that the best efforts section is a sample, so it's not a definitive statement that they didn't disclose 30% of their occupation and employer. It could be the sample methodology works out that's what it is, but I appreciate the auditors putting in that it's a sample, and the deposit issue, my sense is that they didn't deposit within 10 days, and whether or not there's some sort of reason for that is not really something that comes up in the audit context, although my own two cents is the bank issue with the credit cards is something that I have some sympathy for, but that's not something we need to change. So that's my additions to Commissioner Bowerly's audit motion, and I thank her for proposing a middle ground and happy to support that motion, to the extent that motion even now makes sense. But the chairman understands the motion.
I think I understand it, but I think, as you mentioned, we should get some feedback from Mr. Stoltz to see how that fits with something you can live with from your division.
For the most part, I think it's fine. We'll certainly go look at the address issue again. I suspect that at the time, just judging from what's in the report, that we look to see if that was an address that was at least associated somehow, and we didn't. But we'll check it again, and that's fine. We can do that. Just one question about the consultant debt payment. I think it's pretty clear that this was an obligation of the committee that had been accumulating for some months. It was a monthly fee. It went over a period of, 5 months? 5 months. And it was an unwritten contract. At least in the... I think in the accounting sense, it was a debt. Now, whether we've decided that obligations such as that don't require disclosure, I think it would be somewhat of a new approach to it.
How would it be stated in the audit report that you would be comfortable with under those circumstances?
Well, if the commission decides that if it's an unwritten contract and we don't want to include that in the debt, we can do that going forward. Just saying that, certainly in an accounting sense, it's a debt because there was apparently an agreement to pay so much a month every month, and that becomes an obligation at the month. Now, if we had a contract that said, but it's not due and payable until, then I would say fine. But this one... with an oral contract, it's hard to conclude that it wasn't payable, either somewhere near when the services are rendered.
Do I do some clarifying on that?
I kind of look at the fact it's an oral contract. Actually, I see it cutting the other way because there is no specified due date, and that's when it gets tough to really put a fine point on when a personal services type contract results in debt. Now, like I said before, if it's a consultant that actually fronts money out of pocket, that's a different situation. But when it comes to sort of an oral contract with a consultant, to me it feels like we're making new ground going the other way by trying to say this is a debt. Because the practical reality is, and of course, this is not a statement of law, but more one of practical application. This happens every day, and there's oral contracts, and people get paid at some point. There's no specified time, and I don't want to really adopt a standard that all of a sudden causes people to hyperventilate. If there's some intentional hiding of the ball or putting off payment for an extended period of time, that sort of thing, I think that's a different situation. But I think here I don't see it as breaking new ground. But given that I supplemented the motion, you know where I am. I'm curious to see if what others may think.
Commissioner Marilyn.
I was fine with that finding the way it is, but hearing some concern and in an effort to move things forward, I would agree to the amendment of the motion that Commissioner McGann offers. I think it is more difficult when there's an oral agreement, but there are written invoices, and I think that, as I understand it, they, even if they don't state a particular payment date, I think there's some sort of commercially reasonableness that goes with it. And I don't want to suggest that we're opening up, you know, the idea that if you don't have, as long as you don't have a contract, you can sort of pay in a year or in a year and a half. I mean, I think we have to be a little bit careful about that. But I will agree to the addition to the amendment in an effort to move us forward. I'd also like just to make one brief comment with respect to finding three on the addresses. And while I appreciate that the addresses didn't conform to where the address that the agency may have had with respect to the PAC, if it's a local address or Converse, a national address of the entity, I think that's probably related enough for my view. If it is an incorrect address, that's different. As I read the response, they acknowledge that at least there may have been some clerical errors with respect to some of the addresses. So I don't think that, if you know, for example, if there was a change of address, that's to me is a little bit difficult to hold against the committee for not knowing that someone changed an address, someone else changed an address that is housed with us, in fact, that they, you know, they don't have control over that. But obviously people make mistakes, and those are, you know, attributable to the committee in that case.
Yes, excuse me.
I just want to make the point about the reporting of the debts. It's not just reporting of debts. I believe it's all debts and outstanding obligations. So once it was actually incurred, it was an outstanding obligation. And if it wasn't paid during the reporting period in which it was incurred, then it's outstanding. And so regardless, if you're not going to consider a debt, it's still an outstanding obligation. If you look at 104.3D, it clearly says debts and obligations.
Okay, thanks for the clarification. So, how do we want to deal with that going forward, though, in terms of how we interpret what a debt is or an outstanding obligation? Is there any clarification we need on that point? I mean, an oral agreement out west is as good as a written one.
I think, as Lorenzo was trying to say, I don't know that that really is the... is the criteria, whether it's an oral agreement or written agreement. But, you know, if the commission decides they don't want to deal with this one, then we won't deal with this one. And then maybe, you know, we should sort of rethink how we want to look at this sort of thing going forward.
Okay, we have a motion on the table. Is it understood by everyone here? Madam Secretary, you have the gist of the motion. Okay, great. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. 5-0. Thank you very much.